Okay, this is Pamela, and this is Don. Don is the webmaster of Simply Scripts and owner. And Pia is our semi-infamous, famous Swede in Florida.
That's not nice.
Hello, and welcome to Simply Radio. Tonight with us, we have Don and Pia as our panel, and we also have a very special guest who is an author and a speaker and works with applied mythology, and her name is Pamela J. Smith. And I'll turn it over to Pamela now so that she can give us a short bio about herself. Pamela?
Oh, thank you very much, and I appreciate the invitation to be on the show this evening. And you introduced me as an author. That is true. I have 4 books out on the marketplace and a number of seminar CDs. And I'm also an international speaker and consultant and also a filmmaker and have won a few awards for producing and directing. My main work is with applied mythology. I have a company called MythWorks. And what I do is take the wonderful tools of storytelling and applied mythology and bring them to individuals and organizations, be they writers, media makers, business people, entrepreneurs, nonprofit organizations, or I've also worked with the military and other large corporate organizations. So it's always a pleasure to bring these wonderful old concepts of symbols and images and archetypes and the mythic stories and bring those into a modern use so that we can improve our own lives by using these terrific old concepts. So applied mythology for a more powerful reality.
So how does applied mythology work? I mean, how would you use it? Could you give us an example of it?
Yes, certainly. I'll give you an example first within a story context and then within a personal context. Within stories, when people send me their scripts or their novels, I can usually identify 3 or so mythic themes that are running through a story, but it may not be very well defined. For instance, one I am recently working on is a combination of mythic themes that the story isn't strong yet because the first part of the story is on one mythic theme, for instance, stealing fire from heaven. The second 2/3 of the story are about the Pygmalion myth. And then another part of the story is yet another mythic theme. So what I do is to point out to the writer which seems to be the strongest and which would be the most supportive sub-theme so that then we can work towards using the plot points of the mythic theme to strengthening their story and giving it internal integrity. So that's one way to use applied mythology in storytelling. Way that I use it in personal consultations, I'll give you an example of one of my clients who was going from being a immigration attorney to becoming an entrepreneur working in the medical field. And in that instance, I work with archetypes, and she had been on very strongly the warrior archetype. So she was doing this whole warrior path thing when she was out there fighting for immigrants' rights. But as she began to switch to becoming an entrepreneur in the medical instruments field, she had a shift in her archetype. She went to the scientist archetype. So the work that we did together was then to identify how she would differently present herself, and that went all the way to going through the wardrobe and say, okay, you'll want to emphasize this color more than that color. and this type of clothing, and you can wear this type of accessory that will really play up that attitude so that it reflected the archetype that they were embodying.
That's very interesting that you even work with colors with people and such. Do you think those sort of things would translate to writing a script? I mean, the colors that you use and would that be important, do you think, in crafting characters? Do you think that would even get noticed, really?
That's a good question, and I debated that quite a bit in my most recent book, the Symbols, Images, Codes book, because there's a whole section on colors. And because the book is for media makers and not just for writers, I did this whole big section, and for the writers, it really isn't something that in screenplays you will do that often. An example of it being done and being done well is in the screenplay for The Sixth Sense, where the color red is indicative of the presence of the supernatural, of a soul who hasn't passed on. But typically, unless it's really something that's going to stand out, like when she puts on a red dress, this character becomes something different. Typically in screenplays, color is not that dynamically important. Unless it actually is standing for something, it becomes symbolic for something in particular, or it is used to denote a specific change. But that's more left in the hands of the director, the production designer, and the DP.
I have been told by some people that have worked on some really big and famous productions that everything you see on screen has a purpose. Nothing is left to chance. So I'm wondering if, you know, when you were talking about colors and stuff, what people wear, or even the colors of maybe items that are in frame at any second, do you think that subconsciously that plays into this, or do you think that somebody just go, oh, that looks pretty? Or do you think somebody's trying to think a little deeper?
Oh, that's a good question, Pia. I would say I have two levels of answers for that. And one is that typically on a feature film, and this is based on 4 years working in production at Universal Studios and many, many years doing commercials and corporate films and documentaries, etc. When you've got a feature film where you've got the time and hopefully the budget, and you've got a specific production designer working with the director, then absolutely, you're going to see every little item is specifically designed to be that way. And so every color is chosen. One of the first feature films I worked on in Hollywood was Joel Schumacher's Incredible Shrinking Woman. And with the production designer, he chose a palette like the candies, the Necco wafer candies. And so the entire production was based on that color palette.
Wow.
So everything you saw was in the color scheme of Necco wafers. Hmm. Also on commercials, because there is typically, and this was, you know, back when you didn't have YouTube spots and, you know, internet commercials, but typically there's so much money involved in a commercial. You know, you can spend $300,000 in a, you know, one day shoot, and that's a low budget commercial. So the director working with the stylist and the DP will typically consciously select all the colors. Now, when you get into TV, which is often run at a much faster pace, there may not be that much conscious choice of every little item. But I tell you what, Pia, when you asked your question, I thought of what I thought when I was watching Inception. And in the first 10 minutes of that movie, I thought, oh, I'm so glad I was not the prop master on that movie. I'm so glad I was not the production. I'm so glad I wasn't the AD. Oh my gosh. Because you could just tell that every shard of glass was specifically, consciously manipulated. It was magnificently gorgeous. And one of my favorite examples of that was the white hand grenade in the Arctic Mountain section of it. So the short answer to your question is, depending upon the time, the budget, and the professionalism of the people involved in it, absolutely you're right. Every little thing can be consciously chosen. And on the lower end of the scale, sometimes it's, you know, hey, it's good enough for TV.
Good enough for YouTube or Facebook.
Exactly. Exactly. So the standards have gone down. More's the pity, but there you have it.
I've been noticing on your MythWorks topics page that you speak about a lot of different subjects. And I thought that it might be interesting to ask you about a couple of them.
Okay.
One of them was Hollywood myths. What's that about?
Oh, well, that is a presentation that has two parts. It's Hollywood myths on the screen and behind the scenes. And I discuss the various mythic themes that show up in movies. For instance, the don't ask, don't tell, where there's a hidden identity. And when I do this particular presentation, then I give the myth behind it and then give examples of media that is within that same mythic theme. The stealing fire from heaven, the Prometheus myth, and this is when you'll typically have, you know, a teacher who comes in, like Dead Poets Society, a teacher who brings something to the people and gets punished for it. Or lost love rescued, the Orpheus and Eurydice myth. So the first part of the presentation then is the myths that Hollywood uses and recycles and keeps telling and has all of these different versions of. And then the behind the scenes is a recounting of some of the stories that are the, you know, the often told war stories of the Hollywood studios, but then also a lot of those myths about, you know, how many people have you heard say, oh, I just snuck in the back gate at Universal and started working on a show and pretty soon I had a job. Okay, we've heard that Steven Spielberg did that. A lot of people claim to have done the same thing. When you really get down to it, not many of them really did.
Oh, so they're just,
it was a different way.
Just sort of urban myths.
Or, you know, if you hang out in this particular place, you're bound to meet these kind of people, and then you'll get hired on a movie. Or this is the way to go in and do a meeting. So just all those stories that get passed around about how to make it in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
I use a lot of other people's stories. And say, okay, here's what happened to this person. This is their version of it.
Because what I think would be interesting is that we get, when we discuss screenwriting in the forums, we get a lot of myths about screenwriting that come into play.
Oh, yes.
What you should and shouldn't do sort of myths. You know, I thought that would be kind of interesting to find out which ones are really myths and which ones aren't.
Oh, like by page 10, you have to have a turning point?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much.
Grab them the first 10 pages.
Right. And you have to make the hero likable, you know, the save the cat thing.
Right.
Which, you know, I must say, Blake Snyder was a wonderful person and very generous and had a lot of great ideas. But like many of those standard Hollywood screenwriting myths, you know, the proof is often in the lack of it. Somebody breaks the rules rather than following the rules.
But, you know, I just, not to jump in, is that, you know, that there are, you know, directors and writers who break the rules. And what's interesting I see is that with scripts, quite a bit, a very, very small percentage of writers can get away with breaking the rules. And it's a very rare case where a writer has broken the rules and has become really successful. And it's funny because for me, one of my biggest pet peeves, let me give you some background, Pamela. I enjoy reading scripts. I enjoy reading screenplays. I don't enjoy reading shooting scripts. When I start a script, I want to be in the story, and I don't want to be taken out of it. And so for me personally, you know, camera angles, you know, angle in on, and, you know, the camera follows, that takes me out of the story, drives me absolutely bonkers, because I'm not getting the story. And so what happens is that when I mention this to people, and this happens quite a bit, everybody and their mother comes up with these examples of a screenwriter who has camera angles in their script, and they become wildly successful. And every single time, it is a writer-director, like the Coen brothers.
Ah,
their first draft scripts have camera angles in them. Well, because you're going to shoot the bloody thing, and that's okay. And they've already got someone bought in on the story, and they've got the finance. But in order to sell a story, you really need to sell the story, not the movie, and how you're going to do it. So, I mean, that's one thing that just, yes. It's one of these myths that I think, not so much a myth, is that it's a fact that if you're trying to sell a story, you need to tell a story and not tell people how to film it.
Absolutely, I so agree. We make the distinction, most of the story consultants, script consultants that I know who are my colleagues that I discuss these things with, we take great pains to make the distinction for writers, particularly new writers, between a shooting script and a reading script or a selling script. So the script that gets shot, which is often what people read when they start reading scripts, you know, you're told, well, read a lot of scripts. Okay,
right.
That's all well and good, but often what's available is the shooting script.
Exactly.
And it has a shorthand that, you know, anybody in production knows how to read. So it's a different kind of creature than a script which is written to sell.
Yeah.
And it's really different. And in those selling scripts, absolutely, you do not want to jerk around the attention of the reader by putting in those directions, by putting in that production stuff that just really doesn't need to be there. And I'm a big advocate of using adjectives and adverbs in a reading script, in a selling script. You have to make it a pleasure to read. You have to make it engaging.
Hmm. That's interesting. That shatters a myth.
It does.
Yes.
It does. And,
yeah.
You know, and a lot of people say, oh, you don't need all that stuff, you know. Well, those fads come and go, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, look what was selling in the early 80s and look what was selling in the early aughts. And, you know, it's different. So these are fads. They come and go. But good writing and good storytelling is always evocative and engaging.
Do you think that every story has to come from a myth?
Okay. I don't think that everybody who sits down to write a story is going to be consciously referring to a myth when they do it. However, I think that every engaging story, every good story, has a resemblance to a myth, because myths are the stories that we tell ourselves to explain the world around us and within us. And we've been telling these same stories for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So in my work, somebody can have never read, never heard about any myths at all, write a wonderful screenplay, and I can identify its mythic background. Because it's just like it's like a key in music. It's like a frequency of color. You just naturally tap into that sort of thing. It's all your own and it's original and its presentation is unique to you. But the theme, there's always some myth out there that is on that same storyline.
Yeah. I mean, I think that we're kind of raised with myths, even though we just don't realize it. You know, you talk about the hero figure or the mentor figure. One other thing I was actually going to bring up is that there was this, what was it, the expression here? There's only two plots that exist in the entire world.
I think I've heard.
I think you've heard of two, Pia. Yeah. A stranger comes to town and someone leaves town on a journey. And that's it. Which I think it's funny, because when I heard that afterwards, every movie that I watched or show that I watched, this is a stranger comes to town movie, or this is a stranger or someone goes on an adventure. Pamela, I was just kind of curious what your thoughts were on that, is that there really aren't many plots that are available is just people, you know, either rehashing or reinterpretation of plots and themes and archetypes.
Well, I think that's another one of those myths that, see, to me, that is so limiting. And there are many other myths that don't involve any strangers coming to town or going away. So that's too limiting. It's a way to look at things, but it's only a slice of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Joseph Campbell himself, a couple of years after the Hero with a Thousand Faces came out, came back and said, oh, hey, guys, guess what? That monomyth thing I was talking about, not so much. There's a whole bunch of other things out there, too.
You know, it's funny because, you know, I've got a piece of paper in front of me that says, do not mention, you know, Joseph Campbell. I was wondering how long this would go before somebody mentioned Joseph Campbell. I mean, I've read it. It's funny because after you read it and then you watch movies and things, it's suddenly you're pulling these things out that there's really nothing new. This is just a rehash of, you know, Hercules or as you say, Prometheus, which I think is incredible.
Yes.
So I guess, you know, I think I tend to stereotype and limit myself, having read that I kind of naively believe that there's really nothing new in the world. It's just, you know, everything is just something being rehashed and delivered a little differently that catches the viewer or catches the reader.
When you think about it, really, that's the way the world works, though, because everything that's new in the world is all made of the same atoms and molecules that were always here. And so we're all just rehashes of what was here before. And so it makes sense that stories are all just rehashes of what was there before.
Yes, and I would build upon that last statement there and say that it's not so much that there isn't anything new, but that there's more than just that hero's journey. And in an extrapolation on that, I would say, if you were to pick up my book, Beyond the Hero's Journey, it covers many other mythic themes besides just the hero's journey. And I must say, Chris Vogler's book, The Writer's Journey, does a wonderful job with the hero's journey. But a lot of people find that their story isn't the hero's journey, and they've been struggling trying to, you know, fit their plot into these 12 plot points. It's not going to fit because that's not the mythic theme that they're writing. And there are plenty of others. So if you find that the writer's journey, the hero's journey, is not suiting the story that you're telling, you know, check out Beyond the Hero's Journey.
I have a question.
Yes.
You have won awards for filmmaking and directing. And I was just wondering if, did you write those stories? And what were they about? And how much in those films did you apply of your knowledge from your books and your seminar and your that profession about mythology and that sort of thing? How much went into those films?
Oh, thank you for asking. Actually, they were short, comedy shorts, and there was a writer. I came up with the concept, and then a writer actually wrote the story, the dialogue, and we worked together on it, but there was a writer involved. And then how much did I apply these concepts? Actually, quite a bit. And it was even to the effect of, for the characters, one of the books that I wrote is called Inner Drives, and it's how to build characters using the chakras. So by placing a character who's very scientific and is all throat-centered, for those of you who are aware of what the various chakras are, science and logic is all throat center. So you put something like a bow tie to call your visual attention to the throat area. Or if a person is very sacral and they're very sensual, then you would dress them more in, you know, the slinky outfits and go with something more red. So I always try to put that in, and even if I'm just producing and not actually directing, I like to jump in and, you know, offer suggestions when we're doing the wardrobe selections and such as that. So the answer was, yes, I do try to put that into whatever it is that I'm working on, depending on whether or not I'm directing or if the director is open to those kinds of suggestions.
Do you think that had anything to do with the awards, or do you think it was why did they get the awards? Was it the storytelling, the cinematography, directing, the acting, or the overall production? What do you think?
I think the one that I directed and also produced that won an award won it because of the concept and also because of, so it was the concept, the story layout, and the acting.
Do you have plans for other films in the future or anything?
Well, I'm working on a couple of very interesting documentaries right now, and one of them is about the car club culture in Los Angeles. And on that one, I'm producing, and then I'm also directing a documentary on supercomputer point of view of the scientists and taking a look at the cities in which they work as well as the laboratories, the computer labs, and just make all of that really high-tech science much more personal.
What do you prefer? Do you prefer a story that's written, or do you prefer documentary? I'm only asking because I'm a pretty big fan of documentaries myself, and I have attempted to make some myself. I just love people, and I love to hear people and why they do what they do and their lives and things like that. So in a way, even though I try to write screenplays, that actually appeals more to me than filming something that now this happens, then that happens. I love when people just tell me what's going to happen next. You know what I mean?
I love doing documentaries. Absolutely. It's so fascinating. And I guess I'm kind of schizophrenic that way. I also love working on fiction, but there's something so interesting about going into a world that you don't know and having to learn enough about it to translate what the experts are doing. I've been so fortunate in that I've gotten to go many places around the world and dive into lots of different fields of study and work, and you know, from computer science to space exploration and military and indigenous peoples, and it just fascinating.
We're getting toward the end of the show, and I'd like to ask you about one more thing on your MythWorks topics. And
sure.
That would be Alpha Babes.
Okay.
I was just curious about that.
Alpha Babes are exceptional human beings of honor, integrity, courage, compassion, wisdom, who just happen to be in a female body. They are extraordinary heroines. They can also be ordinary people who rise to the occasion. And that can make for wonderful storytelling. And I have recently co-founded the Alpha Babe Academy. And you can go to alphababeacademy.com and learn more about that. And we also have courses. So you can take Alpha Babes 101 and learn more about how to become an Alpha Babe. And then we're also doing Chosen Men, which is the masculine counterpart to an Alpha Babe. And what's wonderful, since I first started giving the Alpha Babe lectures, oh my gosh, probably in 92, so many more women have risen to that level and are doing wonderful, outstanding work that is benefiting so many people. So it's really been wonderful to see that concept played out in reality, you know, just in the nature of evolution and the hard work that people have done for it. Alpha Babes, absolutely. We need more of them. And it's wonderful for storytelling.
Yeah, I noticed that when I was reading the description of the topic, that it looked like something that would really be pertinent to modern storytelling.
Yes, because there are so many more Alpha Babes these days.
Any other questions from any of the two of you, Pia, Dawn?
I think if there was another hour, I think all of us could think of a lot of things, you know,
to ask
about different things. I mean, your experience in Hollywood, your experience about the mythology and all this and that. I mean, and filmmaking and everything, you know, it's always, we're stuck with this 30-minute program.
It'll bring down the site. And actually, to echo it, just to say what Pia said is that, yeah, there's more questions that we really have time for, but this has just been really fascinating.
It has.
There's a lot of useful stuff in here that I think that our listeners can use in their writing, and I can use in mine.
And Pamela's been a great guest, and she's welcome to come back anytime she wants.
Oh, thank you. That would be delightful. And yeah. I would just say in closing to all of your writer listeners to explore the world of mythology. That's where they keep the stories.
Okay, thank you. And that's it for this edition of Simply Radio. Night.